Welcome back, team. Banged Up, season 2, episode 11, I think we're on now. And this is a big one.
It is.
Boats is excited.
This is the most excited I've been, to be fair.
He was onto the WhatsApp even earlier than normal today to get the link.
And you know what? You know what's funny? I'm just reading this comment of what you've sent me. And someone said, well, Dan tube fires and said, does Boats ever answer a question without saying to be fair? So I'm going to say to be fair as much as possible.
That's your old. I mean, we'll come on to that. But that, I'm convinced that's your old, like, kind of footballer media training where it's like, just like, yeah, to be fair. Yeah, we went out there. We gave 110%.
I'm going to start saying frankly instead.
Along with your catchphrase, wow. Claire, how are you?
I'm all right, thank you. There might be a bit of extra noise.
Sleep deprived.
I'm not feeling as fresh this week. It's catching up with me.
It's an exciting one though, isn't it? Because we teased it last week that we had a really big, exciting guest this week. A titan in their field, I think is how we framed it. And we weren't lying.
Titan.
Boats enjoyed that. Claire, do you want to announce who this week's guest is?
This week's special guest is none other than myself, yours truly, Claire Salama.
I'm buzzing off this one, to be fair.
Well, there was nothing short of a clamour from our listeners to hear more about Claire, and ask and ye shall receive. This week's episode is dedicated entirely to our very own Clary Clogs. And we're going to hear all about how you became a prison lawyer, what a prison lawyer actually is, what you do day to day, and lots more. So
I'm ready.
Claire is ready. Let's get into it. So in true biography style, I think let's start at the beginning. You start wherever that beginning is. You choose, Claire. And maybe tell us, yeah, a bit of the kind of the...
Well, I was born.
Yeah, exactly. Go as early as you like. And yeah, maybe just tell us a bit about kind of how you became a lawyer, what kind of drove you to get into that, and yeah, kind of how you ended up where you are now.
So I studied law at university, although if I went back, I wouldn't do that. I would have chosen something else interesting to study and dealt with the law bit afterwards, since you can do a law conversion after you do anything pretty much at university. So, but I didn't. I did law with sociology. So it was a 4-year degree because I was sort of interested in the people side of things.
Let's rewind quickly, Claire, because I'm not sure about you, Boats. I want to know what Claire was like at uni. Was the reason you didn't want to do law, you wouldn't do law if you went back again, it was too restrictive on your social life? What were you like?
I think there's not many subjects that are too restrictive on your social life, are there, really? Apart from maybe being a doctor. But no, it wasn't too restrictive. It was quite... it was quite dry for me. So one aspect of the law is like very book heavy and very like, oh, what's this legislation and what year did that happen in? What's the case? And that is not so much me as a lawyer. I'm much more, what I like about what I do is it's much more problem solving, and it's much more sort of, okay, you are using the law to get a conclusion that you want, or to, you know, to argue something. But there's a lot more sort of instinct about it. There's, it's a lot more kind of pragmatic. And I don't find the studying of law to be that way. And I'm not interested particularly in the history of a statute that happened thousands of years ago. And that's not my strength. So I was probably out of my depth in terms of a lot of people there. It was very academic university, and there was a lot of very smart people there that wanted to run the world. So no, it wasn't about social life. I had a lovely social life.
And at which stage did you realize you didn't want to run the world? Where did you go? So after graduating, during the degree, how did you decide what to do next?
I think during my degree, I figured out what type of law I didn't want to do. So I wasn't interested in the kind of corporate commercial world, which at my university, there was a big push for. You know, all these law firms were coming in, talking to everyone, all these magic circle law firms, you know, saying, come work here, we'll pay for your training contract, but it was business, finance, corporate law, very, yeah, not for me. Knew I didn't want to work for one of the big guys. And I wanted to do something with people. So I, when you kind of think of the more obvious routes about people, in terms of law, you've got stuff like family law, you've got criminal law. Those are probably the two that get kind of sort of put about most at university that you know about. I didn't know anything about prison law at the time. I don't think anyone did. There's sort of, it wasn't so much about what I knew I wanted to do. It was that what I knew I wanted to stay away from. And I wanted to do something more social justice based and with people. So I got work experience in those types of fields. And at first, I didn't know if I wanted to be a barrister or solicitor. So for people that don't know, a solicitor is often the person in the office, is often the person kind of in the office, or the barrister is the person that goes to court. So most solicitors won't actually go to court. They will prepare a case and then hand it over to a solicitor to go and do the sort of public speaking bit in court. And I thought, oh, maybe I'll be a barrister. You know, that will be more variety. That will be interesting. But the reality is barrister's lifestyle is super tough in those types of areas. It's, you know, you don't know where you are any day. It's, you're being sent to different courts. The night before, you earn absolutely no money doing kind of criminal bar work. And it's quite stressful. You're self-employed. And I realized again that if I was interested in the contact with the individuals, that you're doing that more in a role as a solicitor, because you're the person taking instructions from someone. You know, you're building the case up, you're figuring out what the answer is, and then you're giving it to the barrister to do the more bookish bit, you know, to speak the law in court, which is what I figured I didn't really like, even though I like arguing. But you get to do that as a solicitor as well. So I ended up getting paralegal work after I finished my training. So you have to go to university, then you had to do another year of training after that, at which I did in London. And then I got work as a paralegal, which is a sort of, I don't know, you work under a solicitor doing either their sort of, it can range depending on where you work, from sort of being a PA secretary to sort of actually doing much more on the ground. And I was really lucky. I got paralegal work in this small civil liberties, like human rights firm. And I got absolutely tons of responsibility because it was so small, and way more than I would have done if I went and did a training contract elsewhere. And I think I've spoken to you before, sometimes probably too much responsibility at the beginning. But that firm specialized in all sorts of human rights stuff. So there was actions against the police, actions against prison. So that sort of suing the police for anything, you know, for your treatment, for example, in police custody or wrongful arrest. We did inquests, which is where there's an investigation into a death. So these were deaths either in police custody or in prison.
I want to just jump in quickly there on something you said about, you said that you got given at times way too much responsibility. I'm sure I'm not the only one that wants to hear about a time you got chucked in at the deep end, because I remember hearing a couple of stories secondhand about this. But can you tell us a time that happened?
Oh, lots of times. I mean, it was the best thing for me, learning-wise. It was probably not always the best thing sometimes for the clients. I don't know. I was young and I would be going in, you know, there's no money involved in these firms. There's not any time. They're absolutely swamped. So they haven't got the ability to sort of handhold you during everything you do. It's very much like, just get on with it. And yeah, there were times, you know, that in terms of prison work, that firm specialized in representing quite high, a lot of high profile clients, very on, you know, life sentences in what they call the CSC, which is called the Close Supervision Center. And they are sort of prisons within prison. So within the highest secure prison, within a Cat A prison, there will be, in a few of them, there is like a separate center inside the middle of the prison, which has fresh gates, fresh staff, fresh entry requirements, you know, fresh security. And they are holding what they consider to be the most dangerous prisoners or risky prisoners, either to themselves or to other prisoners or to the outside within that unit. And that, you know, there's not a huge number of them. And the clients that we had at that place were a lot of those people. So you would be going in to visit them. I don't know, it must have been sort of 22, 23 years old by myself, with little experience of how to deal with these people. And yeah, they're a lot older. They've been there a long time. And they're quite intimidating individuals.
So, I mean, that is, so presumably you'd heard of, I mean, you're saying these are some of the most notorious kind of criminals that, you know, lots of people will have heard of some of these names. You're 23 years old, you're very fresh into the job, and you're being sent in alone to go and interview them, talk to them. Do you remember kind of the first time you did that and how you felt?
I think I might have mentioned on a previous one, the first time that I tried to take a pen into one of people, and I got told I wasn't allowed to take a pen in with them, and I didn't understand the severity of that. You know, and you'd have a visit in a clear glass booth, you know, just you and this person and three prison officers waiting outside. Can I remember the first one? I can't remember the first one. I mean, we had one client who, you know, and a lot of these people have very, very significant issues. So I can remember one client who had very significant mental health issues and had been inside for an extremely long time, and had gone in for something quite minor and then had committed very serious violent offences whilst in custody and had ended up in the CSC unit. And he used to complain that the general public didn't know his name when he would say, quote unquote, that he was worse than Charles Bronson, who was on his wing. And he didn't like that. Like, he wanted... He was so far down. It's like, if I'm this supposedly bad and dangerous, why is Bronson getting this name as being the most notorious dangerous prisoner when he felt he was? So, you know, there's conversations like that, which are very strange. So yeah, it's an eye opener. It was an eye opener, but I found it fascinating, and I didn't know anything about prison law before then. And I think this is something to clarify. I thought that it was all kind of criminal law. I didn't realize that there was a separate branch of it. So how it's distinct is that criminal law deals with representing a person with a charge that they've been faced with. So either defending them to say this person didn't do it, or to prosecute them, where effectively you're working for the Crown Prosecution Service, the CPS, and you're putting a case against them why they did do an offence. If you're defending them, you're going to be working with them up, you know, it might be from police arrest in the police station up until being in court at trial. They might go guilty, or they might go not guilty. There might be a trial, then there'll be a sentencing if they're found guilty. So that's the role of the criminal solicitor. That's not what I do. I don't get involved with speaking to the majority of anyone I work with. I don't get involved about whether they did or didn't do it. The majority of people I'm meeting after they've been convicted. It's not always the case, but that's for the most part. So I don't have to get into the realm of have you done this most of the time, or what's your defence, because the courts found them guilty. Now, some of them will still maintain their innocence past that point, but from where you're working with them, you're working for them on the basis they've been found guilty, they've been given a sentence. Most of the people I work with have been given prison sentences, hence being a prison solicitor, and you're dealing with their treatment inside.
Claire, have you ever, obviously after being given a client and once they've been convicted, have you ever read the paperwork and thought they've been harshly done by and felt sorry for them?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I feel sorry for anyone that's in prison, because I think the system is so bad, even though there are people that have done some things, you know, I accept that people have done wrong things. But yes, what in terms of whether they're innocent or whether they've been...
Yeah. Even in terms of sentencing you just feel like they've been hardly done by.
Yeah. So there's definitely a handful of people that I've met that I think are real genuine miscarriages of justice, especially some of those older lifers. There's a couple, you know, that have served years and years and years and years, and I don't think have done it based on my knowledge. Where I work now, we also deal with appeals. So we can make an appeal on behalf of someone that we think has been either wrongly convicted or has been given too harsh a sentence. But you only kind of get one shot really at an appeal. And so there are times when you'll go for an appeal, but it'll be unsuccessful. And then you'll still feel that they have either have got too long a sentence or shouldn't have been convicted of what they were convicted of. It doesn't necessarily always mean that they haven't done anything, just not to the extent. Yeah, yeah. So for example, you might have someone who's been convicted of murder, but you think actually this is manslaughter. And that's a, you know, huge difference in the sentencing and what's on your record. So it's really important to try and clear that. But, you know, it doesn't mean that they haven't been involved in some way. Then there are other people who you think, I'm not sure you've been involved in this mess at all. And others who have been, really harshly sentenced. And some of that is because if they haven't had proper representation at the time, then they, things that might have reduced their sentence haven't been raised. And that's especially the case with a lot of young people, for example, who might have additional needs that haven't been kind of picked up on, or their background hasn't been properly explored, and the sentencing has been sort of rushed through and they haven't got appropriate paperwork, and they might end up with a much longer sentence than they might otherwise, or if they have a diagnosis of a mental health condition or a learning disability that hasn't been understood previously. So I do work on some appeals, but the majority of it is sort of treatment in prison is the prison lawyer role.
Do you ever notice that a client has kind of looked down at you in terms of maybe because you're a woman or maybe because you're young? Because I know some people that they might expect to have a lawyer who's going to be older, and where you're young and you're a female, that might be a problem to some people. Has that ever been an issue?
Yeah, I think for some of the older people I've worked with, you know, you might be younger than their children. And so there is that element of, oh, can this person do a good job?
Yeah.
Especially when I was younger, you know, I can understand that feeling from someone. I'm sure that if I was within the system, you know, we all make, you know, jump to stereotypes, judgments of someone's capability. Hopefully once they start working with me, they realize that I am capable. But also, you know, I specialize in working with young people, so that the sense of the age with my clients doesn't make a difference. And to be honest with you, actually, the problem doesn't really come from the clients. Once they work with you and they can see that you've got their best interest and you're fighting for them, you're listening and you're believing in them, I think that the prejudice comes from the system. So the judges, the parole board officers, you know, members, I think they are the people that I feel more aware that I'm a youngish female than with the clients.
How long did you work with that organization where you were doing with the human rights one, where you were working with those guys for?
I did my training contract there, so I must have been there about maybe three or four years. I was there in the end and worked with the best people, some of my closest friends. One of my closest friends, I met there doing my training contract, you know, and it was only a tiny place. And the others I worked with have all gone on and trained with, they've all gone on to do amazing things as well. So it was an incredible place. Yeah.
Did you find that, is that kind of a bonding experience then? Because you're all kind of the people there, you're not like these guys that have gone off to the magic circle to earn big bucks. You're there to kind of really make a bit of a difference, and your motivation is different. Did that kind of bond you, I think, as a group?
Definitely. I mean, I did my training contract. I believe I got paid at the time £16,000 to do my training contract, alongside which I had to pay.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, I had to pay fees to finish my law qualification. If you go into a magic circle firm or any of those big corporate ones, you're probably on, at the time, probably £30,000. I mean, and that could be a modest underestimate. and they get paid for their law degree. So the company pays them for their qualification and also then rewards them with a very nice wage. So yes, I think it's definitely a bonding experience. And the things that you're seeing, the things that you're hearing are quite unique. And that definitely brings you together. And, you know, it's chaos. Like, it was the type of office where there was piles of paperwork reaching the ceiling. And there just wasn't time or money for the organization of things. And, you know, it was fairly ramshackled and run down in a very lovable way. But everybody's, as you say, everybody was in it for the same reasons. And you were all angry about a system together and trying to make change and improve things for people. So I find it a very rewarding environment. No, it's not glossy. There's no canteen. There's no perks to the job whatsoever. But its reward comes in other ways.
How can you stay motivated if the papers, if the money's not good? Because surely it gets to a point, as much as your intentions are pure, surely it gets to a point when you're like, this is shit. And I've seen and probably had solicitors that probably don't give a fuck because there's situations like that, and I get it now.
Yeah, and I think you end up with two things. One is you end up with a lot of solicitors doing a bad job. Bad job's not quite the right word. Doing minimal amount of work because they're doing what they're paid for, and they might be doing very good work within that time, but it's just not enough time, and they've got pressures over them to be bringing in more money or to keep going, or, you know, depends on how they're being paid by the firm. So that's one big problem. And another is, yeah, people leave because, as you say, I think there reaches a point when the rewards that you're getting of your warm, fuzzy feeling and enjoying your job and finding it rewarding don't outweigh the amount of money that you're receiving. So a lot of people also take on some private work alongside it, which is when they can be paid slightly more normal rates, or the firm might do some private work or take some civil actions, for example, and they get paid slightly differently than the straightforward prison law.
You did your training, so you did 3-4 years with that first organization, and then you moved on to where you are now, is that right?
Yeah, so I worked for
an organization that works predominantly with younger vulnerable people.
So it's a charity that campaigns for prison reform in general, you know, so it does a lot of policy work, a lot of campaigning. And then within that charity, there is a legal department, and we're the only specialist young person led legal department. So in prison law. So we represent people 21 and under to reflect that kind of YOI or secure training center. So that's what we specialize in. And that's what I've done for the last, 10 years, is specialize in young people there. So it's different that, you know, the clientele can be a lot more vulnerable. Their needs can be much greater. You know, they don't have the same ability to advocate for themselves in the system. It's a lot more tragic, you know, often how they've got themselves there when you're looking at their paperwork and their history. But on the plus side, you're seeing a lot more capability for change, I think, and for brighter futures, you know, by helping these people. So there feels much more, I think there's more hope within those cases.
But Claire, saying that, where you get a lot of the juvies and you get them young, do you see they're in the system early and it fucks them already, where there's kind of no going back?
Yeah, they say, I mean, I think all of the data is like that from the moment that you have your first encounter with anything to do with the criminal justice system. So we're talking about being arrested or stopped and searched, or your first ever communication with police or whatever it may be, that has a huge damaging effect on the chances that you'll end up in the criminal justice system. That makes sense. So the kind of the younger that happens, and that sort of leads into it, that once it's happened, even if it's nothing to do with you or you're just randomly stopped and searched, it's more likely to lead you into it. So yes, there's really as I say, really tragic situations, and rates of reoffending are bad. And you see people go through the system again and again because it's really difficult to get out of. But you can make huge differences to the type of support that they're getting on release, on accommodation, on social services packages, on trying to get people employed. You know, there's lots of people who've never, well, I mean, you know, people can go into custody from the age of 10. So it's young. And for some people, when you read what they've been through, it can feel inevitable that they've ended up there. You know, that everything was kind of stacked against them. And you thought, if it wasn't for this, it might be for something else.
Yeah. How do you cope with that, Claire? Because I think, you know, from my, you know, brief encounter with the system, you know, having not really seen much more than what you read in the papers before that, my overall feeling was just, not despair, but you just realize how fucked the system is. And it's just this giant oil tank to turn around. I mean, there is no quick fix to any of this.
Definitely.
And it's not going to happen in the short term. So how do you deal with that on a kind of day-to-day basis, where you've got to keep going back into work and seeing this, and you're kind of dealing with people where, with the greatest intention, it must be very difficult to see a way out for some of these guys. How do you kind of distance yourself and cope with that?
I think there's two things. One is, it's amazing to work in a place like I do, where the bigger picture is wider policy change. So, you know, on the one hand, the organization is trying to lobby Parliament for changes and to make wide reform to the system. And on the other hand, you then get to do the individual and fight for that individual circumstances. So that's something really amazing to be part of. And I think that helps, the bigger picture helps, when you can see case after case going through the same possibly preventable problems. But, you know, as I said, it is quite a problem solving role. It is that you can make real tangible differences. You can form really amazing relationships with young people and sort of see a lot of change happen. And, you know, it's very immediate. It can be that this person is going to be released or not going to be released because they haven't got accommodation. You know, initiate a challenge with social services, boom, they've got accommodation. You know, it can be very, you know, what you're achieving is very tangible and can be very in front of you. You know, you're physically releasing a person from custody, or you're helping them, you know, stand up for themselves or advocate for themselves about something. You know, it's, you can see it. You can see how important it is to the young person to be participating in a process and having somebody fight for them. And the result, you know, the result is very, is there. I mean, you don't always get the right result or what you want, but I think that is very motivating for me, and to be able to see it in front of your face. You know, it's not just a theoretical thing.
Have you ever had a time where you've not felt like giving up, but where it really, you know, where it really got too much for you, or got on, you know, just kind of, or have you found you've always had this kind of, you know, just ability to keep on trucking?
Keep on trucking. I think it helps that if you work with great people who believe in the same things you do, and you can, you know, debrief with them, and you've got to be able to have a laugh about some of the things that you've seen and heard, because if you don't, you know, you would just fall into the sadness of it all. I mean, there are definitely situations that can be very overwhelming. You know, you deal with a lot of people with significant mental health problems. You know, a lot of people who want to take their own lives or are talking about feeling suicidal. You know, in, I think the statistic is something like every 4 days somebody dies in prison. You know, so a lot of those statistics are grueling, and yeah, you read awful, horrible things, but I don't know. Yes, it can be overwhelming. No, I don't feel that I need to leave yet. I haven't got burnout. The pros still outweigh the cons.
You must get, like, obviously, as being as professional as you are, even, you're still a human. You must get, have soft spots for some of your clients and want to go that little bit extra. But obviously, in some cases, it's like, there's nothing more you can do to help them. Do you ever feel like that?
Again, where I work, we're very fortunate that we do have the funding involved where we can go the extra mile for the young people that we represent. You know, it doesn't just have to be so open and shut the case. And I think that's one of the amazing things. And the soft spots and the relationships with the young people is why I'm in it. You get excellent, you build up really amazing relationships over years. There are some people I've worked with for nearly the whole time that I've been there. And those are the amazing things, how well you can get to know them and they can trust you. And, you know, you can speak to these people every day for years. There are definitely times when you can't go any further. Yes. But I think what helps is if the young people or any of your clients, if they see or feel that you have done as much as you can, as gone as far as you can, then, you know, they are accepting or resigned to that situation as well, that sometimes there's nothing more you can do. There will always be unfairness in the system that they're at the, you know, that they've got the brunt of. So that is hard. But I think if you and your client think that you've done as much as you can, then that's the best that you can do.
Have you found that since you've become a mum, you find it harder to distance yourself emotionally from that? From, especially now that you work with younger people, do you find that's impacted it or not really?
To clarify, not since becoming a mum 3 weeks ago, 3 years ago as well. So much has changed in 3 weeks. No, do I think it's impacted? I think if anything, it just reminds you how lucky I was with my childhood, and that already my children have opportunities isn't quite the right word, but have, you know, been born into situations a lot better than so many of the clients that I see, you know, and that comes from right from the beginning, and how helpless they are to be born in those situations or to have the childhoods that they do and the experiences and how hard that is for them. So yeah, I think it's just a reminder.
So yes, yeah, so we reached out to our listeners, and this was obviously a question we'd asked all our guests throughout the series. Money's no object, no red tape, one change you would make to the justice system. And that was kind of across the whole spectrum of it. And we had some really kind of interesting answers, I think. And I think it would be good to see if we can get our answers on this one as well. So I think the first one I want to go to, we had one from someone called Kirsty who messaged us in. And it's interesting. This is actually what my one change would be, I think, is change the jury system. Because I think, you know, she mentions here that it's people's emotions come into decision-making. And Kirsty talks about how she had her own experience of being assaulted and, you know, just how kind of traumatic that experience was. And then, you know, the person was ultimately found not guilty and received kind of no consequences. And I think that's it. I think in these kind of, especially in these big cases where it's a serious crime that's being discussed. And I think that this is something that's been really highlighted more recently in things like Making a Murderer and, you know, these kind of documentaries that go into it. For me, watching those, it's really highlighted how flawed the jury system, the idea of a jury is, that you have these, you know, 12 humans on there, and we're just so easily influenced by our own biases and by, you know, how quickly we make a decision on whether someone is guilty and how impossible that is to then change someone's mind back. So that was the first one. Claire, what are your thoughts on the jury system?
The jury system, I think it can go wrong, definitely. But I think it can go right. It obviously depends who you are and depends on the luck of the jury. But, you know, there are a few sort of set of cases where you can have, they're called tribal either way cases, so that you could be in front of a judge or you could choose a jury. In that choice, I would probably choose a jury. I would probably rather put my fate in 12 people than I would one person, especially if that one person was less likely to represent who I was, who I am. So, you know,
yeah.
If I was a young black man, I would probably choose a jury over a white, middle-class, white, middle-aged man, for example. Obviously, it depends on the circumstance of everything. But I think it is the best of a bad system, as they say. I think there are definitely flaws to the jury system, but I would probably rather take that risk myself.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting one because I think my uneducated view on this is that as humans we love that we like to have closure on something and we like to have that kind of certainty of event, and so you know it kind of goes if there's kind of uncertainty on someone's guilt or not. Just human nature is that you would prefer the outcome of closure, knowing that you've got the guilty person there locked up. That's what we want. And I think there's just leaning towards believing what we want to believe, interpreting evidence, data, whatever, to kind of get that result. And as a result, you do then end up with these kind of situations where you have innocent people being found guilty. And it was interesting earlier in the series, we asked the question about whether people would prefer to have an idea of potentially more guilty people being released in a system that did not lock up innocent people, as opposed to the other way around, where you're kind of risking locking up innocent people, but you've got this safety net of, you know, you're then not letting potentially guilty people out, if that makes sense. Which was, yeah, and actually interesting, more people came back saying they would rather risk having someone guilty be released and not risk locking up someone that's completely innocent. But we don't seem to have a system that reflects that. I don't know if there is there, Claire, a viable alternative that has been, I mean, we're in 2021 now. It just strikes me. We've had this kind of jury system for 100 odd years. Is there nothing that's been kind of promoted, or is there an alternative that is out there that anyone has suggested?
It's a good question. Not that I'm aware of. I mean, you know, some countries don't have juries. I think the alternative all depends on who's making the decision if it's not a jury. So if you're only having it with a judge, then who are your pool of judges? Where is their training come from? Where is their, you know, that's a potential way to solve it, isn't it? I mean, you just potentially, but you've got the same problem with getting a judge to be as impartial or, you know, a fair representation of people as you do the jury, and you've got a better chance with 12 people probably than you do with one who have come from different, you know, different variety of backgrounds.
I think moving past kind of sentencing and the court system, I think moving on to kind of, let's say, the more prison reform idea. We've had an interesting question from, I'm going to try and put it, some people have these weird Instagram names. It's called the C4 Melbar Whiskey. Interesting name. I don't know. But his or her point is interesting, that it's more about an awareness campaign about, you know, the purpose of prison and the fact that being sent, the idea being that, just, you know, being sent to prison is a punishment in itself. You know, you're being removed from your family or environment. And I think that links to a lot of questions. We've had a number of people kind of messaging similar kind of stuff about moving to a more, I think the kind of Scandinavian model is one that's been mentioned quite a lot, but kind of a model of rehabilitation as opposed to punishment within prisons, which I think is a really interesting, and that's the kind of, yeah, very progressive approach, which, you know, I personally would be in favor of. Boats, maybe one for you. How much did you feel going through prison that there was an element of rehabilitation there? Not for yourself personally, but just kind of more generally.
That's a tough one. I don't really feel like there was a big element of rehabilitation. I think it was just more of a, it's just boring as fuck. There was nothing to improve you. Like they had the your token courses and whatnot, but they aren't really.
Did you do any courses?
The ones on my sentence plan, like thinking skills and all of that, but they're bollocks. Like, they're not going to fucking help you. Like, I just remember, I think I even, one of my sentences, I did a pack in my cell. And then it's just literally just a tick a box. A lot of things are just a tick a box. Like, I just got the idea that it wasn't really rehabilitation. It was just to tick a box to say you've done it. And then off you go.
No, exactly. I think, yeah, I think we talked about this a bit before, that I think in Rochester, wasn't there, there were a few kind of vocational courses. There was like a bricklaying course, a plumbing course. And so there were courses like that, which were, you know, people would get qualifications they could use on the outside. But to give you an idea, and so I did my PT course inside. So that was a good example of, I got a qualification in prison. I've used it since. I now use that for work, which is great. There were, I think, 12 spaces on that course. You know, so you're talking about in a prison of 800 people, they ran that course, I think, once in a year. So that's 12 people on one course. I think they were similar. So you're probably talking, I think there were 30 or 40 spaces in a prison of 800 people in a year. So that's probably, you know, within the turnover, you're talking over 1,000 people. So there are courses that help, but a very small percentage. And then there's a lot of completely useless courses that people are doing themselves. And it is, but
bro, I'll be honest, even you doing the PT course, does that rehabilitate you from doing crime? That's what I'm saying. Even them sort of courses, do they actually rehabilitate you? I think you can.
Claire may know a bit more on this. I think the statistics are pretty good on, you know, I think the number one factor, they say, of preventing people from reoffending is gaining meaningful employment afterwards. So I suppose there is a good argument there that gaining a qualification and being able to leave and immediately start in a kind of qualified work, you know, whether it's bricklayer or plumber, you know, where people can earn a decent salary and earn a living. I don't know this. I don't know.
Do you think, though, that the other 11 people that did the course that year have the same outcome that you have? Or do you think that your innate qualities, you know, and your general education and your background and your, you know, there weren't additional struggles when you came out? No, you didn't have a job because it was impossible because you'd been in custody during that time, but you didn't not have a job because of qualifications or opportunities or, you know, ability. Do you see what I mean? I'm not trying to undermine what you've done. That's brilliant. And I'm glad that it's worked out for you. But, you know, you didn't also have the struggle of accommodation on release that you had to sort out before you had a job, or, you know, the intellect to take that forward or the motivation as support. You know, and I'm also not trying to undermine the qualification, because that qualification is much better to be offered than not in custody. But I just wonder about what the other 11 people are doing with it. Was it so good? Was it rehabilitation, like Boats is saying, for those people?
No, I think that's a completely fair question. And yeah, I'm not a fair case study, I don't think, on that, because I came from, yeah, if you take the context of people in prison, I came from an unusually stable background, you know, affluent background, you know, and I had a myriad of benefits that majority of people in that prison system that I encountered didn't have. So yeah, it's a tough one for me to say what was a bigger factor. I mean, I think I'm simply quoting like a statistic, I think, that is often relayed, that like, I think it's like 70% of people that get into work afterwards do not reoffend. But you're right. I think, like, you know, I look at that, it would be really interesting to see what happened to the other people on that course and similar courses. And yeah, I mean, that's the other thing, is my instinct is that social surroundings and factors around that are a bigger factor, because you can get a qualification, that's brilliant, but if you walk out the gates and you're straight back into a, you know, criminal environment or that kind of stuff, it's going to be so difficult not to. So yeah, my instinct would be that social factors are probably play a bigger part than coming out with a qualification, which is, yeah, I think again, something that a lot of the guys touched on, I think a lot of that comes back to funding, I think, doesn't it? I think, you know, going through the prison system, there were a lot of really great people trying to make a change and a difference. And ultimately, a lot of that comes down to being hamstrung by what they can do. And I don't know the details of this, but there was lots of, you know, like those external companies running courses in there that they got paid a decent wedge of money for every person that did that. I'll give one example, the web design course I did in Rochester, which I think I've mentioned before, which, I mean, to say that would not
I've seen your Instagram skills though.
Well, that said, yeah, my Canva skills, designing our Instagram posts, yeah. But no, I think that, you know, that what the skills I learned on that web design course, I just didn't see how they would be transferable in any sense, like, to leave. But that's a box tick. That's a private company that's been paid, like, you know, I think it was like over £1,000 for me doing that course or something. And you just kind of go, well, no one's got anything like this. And that's a huge wedge of cash. So I think there's huge inefficiencies, I think, there in that system that could maybe be looked at. And yeah, talking about, you know, whether we change the emphasis more to reform than punishment. And interestingly,
and going, I definitely think that, I mean, I think our system, whatever they say it is about punishment. You know, the people that go in have done something wrong. They have hurt individuals or a community or themselves, but we go on to punish them and hurt them effectively. I mean, it's almost a revengeful system, you know, when we put them in these conditions. And I think that actually the principle underneath it all should be to try and make things better. You know, and as I've said before, I think one of the most basic things to remember is that apart from a handful of people who are serving all life tariffs, you know, most of those individuals in prison are coming back out into society at some point. So it's in everybody's benefit for them to come out better individuals in better communities, in safer communities, than to be punishing them and making things worse, you know, treating them like animals or not giving them any opportunities and them just languishing. So, you know, it's in all of our benefits. It's in the taxpayer's benefit. It's in the community's benefit. It's in the individual who's gone to prison. It's in the staff's benefit. It's for the victims, you know, everybody really. And they're all coming back out. So they should come out better than they went in, not worse, which is what they're doing at the moment. The statistics are that the majority of people that go into prison and come out commit another crime. That's the statistics, the majority of them.
No, absolutely. And I think the emotional response for people, and I think looking, I'm not going to delve into it because I genuinely wonder how much of it is genuine sentiment about bringing back things like capital punishment and stuff, or whether it's people looking for a reaction with a comment. But I think attitudes like that is quite an emotional response, like so-and-so has done a bad thing, they should be punished. But actually, you know, just the objective view is that that does not work. You know, capital punishment or severe punishments or whatever was around for however long, and it didn't stop people committing these crimes. So the objective kind of view, and I think it's the view taken by some of these Scandinavian countries and stuff like that, is that we should just try and reform these people, and they've got their rates of preventing reoffending and stuff are significantly better than ours. So yeah, I agree. I think that kind of, look, if we just want to, you know, I mean, no matter who you are, you want to stop people committing crimes. And the way that's been shown to do that is to try and help rehabilitate people inside. And that is not done, I don't think, by locking someone in a cell for 23 hours a day with fuck all to do and a bit of Jeremy Carl to watch on the TV. So it's an interesting debate, that one that is not going to be solved. And I think, unfortunately, whether you agreed or disagreed with Peter's politics as a conservative when he came on, I think what was quite frustrating to hear was that, although I think we were all probably a bit surprised by how, but maybe progressive, maybe not be the right word, but, you know, slightly more liberal, their views and some of the initiatives they were trying to set up there, was just how hamstrung they are by the political system, whereby, you know, with the best will in the world, some of these politicians just won't go for it because it does not sit well with the people that read the Red Tops and the Telegraph and that kind of stuff. So that was an interesting, if slightly depressing, insight into how our system works and how slow it's going to be to impact any change. So, yeah. Claire, I want to go back because I think actually rewind what we did. We did have a number of specific questions for you from our listeners. And I think it would be good to maybe ask a couple of those. Nina asked, how much of your job is spent at a desk versus with clients in prison? So kind of on a logistical point, how do you split your time on those ones?
Well, pre-lockdown, we're probably going into prison a couple times a week. Lockdown stopped all visits, so they did bring in much better virtual, you know, visits and stuff. So we were still kind of speaking directly to our clients, but from our desks, which was no bad thing in many ways, but it shouldn't be an alternative. It needs to be an addition to the in-person visits. You just can't get the same rapport, especially with, you know, young people and people with specific vulnerabilities or needs. So yeah, we were going into prison. I was probably going to prison a couple times a week before. nothing at all during lockdown. And obviously I'm on maternity now. So hopefully not going into prison on maternity. Though I did on my last one to visit.
Keep your nose clean.
Socially. Socially. And no, and I did some work for Prison Radio. I got to go into prison in Brixton. Yeah. So hopefully in-person visits will return soon.
Well, yeah, fingers crossed, hopefully, yeah. And I think that must be, yeah, lockdown has been miserable for all of us, but I can promise you it's been significantly worse inside prisons, both first-hand accounts and second-hand. So yeah, here's hoping. Next one is kind of a bit of a two-parter I'll link to here. So Simon Fletcher asked, this is one we got asked a few times, so it'd be good to clear up. How did you meet Robin Boats and how did the idea of starting the podcast come about?
Well, we can all answer this one, really. It might have come up before. Rob and I have a mutual friend, very close mutual friend, who was involved with Rob in custody. So that's how we kind of came to know each other, right? And you got released. I visited my friend a few times. I've met you both on a social visit when I was pregnant the first time around, I believe.
You did, yeah.
I did, yeah, in Rochester. So lining up for the cheese toasties or whatever it is that we got demanded to buy.
One of those slightly awkward prison visit moments. Hey, so what have you been up to?
Hey, how much cash did you bring in?
Not a lot this morning.
Some snacks. I think we met there. And then what has it come about, really? Rob, you contacted me after your release to talk through some ideas about possibly doing something. I was doing Prison Radio at the time and was on maternity and a bit bored, I think. And we sort of spoke about it together, didn't we? And then Boats came on board and then we met up and did it from there. So it's a sort of joint venture, unless anyone sees it differently.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it was. Yeah, no, I think that is...
Rob's sitting on his hands going, it was not a joint venture.
Well, no, I think it was. Well, I think the initial idea was mine, but I think I came, you know, chatted to Boats, and then we had a very kind of raw idea that we wanted to do a podcast about prison to explain what it was like to be in there. And then the three of us developed it to become what it actually turned out to be, series one. I very clearly remember Claire's idea was to make it sort of chronological order, which kind of, yeah, made it make a lot more sense as we went through.
And I said, I can remember, a person. We had a long phone conversation. Yeah, make it personal, not political.
Claire, there's a question from Phoebe, and it says, hi, Claire. I'd love to know what one piece of individual life advice you would give to both Rob and Boats individually. P.S. Many congratulations on your new baby.
Thanks, Phoebe. Big question. In short, I would say... don't be cocky. And I mean that in the sense of like, don't think you're invincible and be cocky about, yeah, it being a past, everything being a past experience and not being, you know, at risk of anything in the future. And don't do anything stupid. Don't do anything stupid. That would be my advice.
I can't make that kind of promise. I mean, I will almost certainly do stupid things, but I'll try not to do the ones that will get
Don't
me back in prison.
Do criminally stupid things, please.
Noted. Good. I can almost guarantee that. Needham Runner says, have you ever been asked to bring items in for cash?
Not seriously, no. Though I do know someone who has and know of someone, I should say. Not, I don't know them personally, but I do know that people have tried to do that and it hasn't ended up well. You see the statistics in, like, if you go to Aylesbury, they have at the front of the visits desk, it used to always have numbers and it would say, you know, five people were caught bringing contraband in this week or whatever. It would tell you and what had happened to them, and it doesn't work out well. So no, I have not been asked to do so, and I would refuse if I had. Obviously.
Exactly. Everyone knows you're whiter than white, Claire. They wouldn't even
Everyone knows, so. Yeah. I'd be too scared.
Best way,
isn't it?
Well, I think that's kind of largely, I think we've covered pretty much everything that we got asked through. Claire, I think that's been so interesting. It's definitely, I mean, a bit like when we did Boats' episode, when I found out his story.
It's been really interesting. Genuinely very enjoyable. I don't talk much, but I feel like that's...
Not very lighthearted.
I spoke the most I've ever spoken today.
Definitely. Well, and if you thought you were talking a lot there, Boats, you get, I mean, hopefully by the time the listeners hear this, they will have seen this. Don't psh me. Rules are rules, mate. We agreed this. You will be announcing with a selfie video Claire's episode on Instagram. So if people are hearing this and not seeing it, they know Boats has not kept his end of the bargain.
All right, cool. Cool.
I can't wait to see how legally binding it will be.
Claire, you're a lawyer. You saw that. That is an oral contract. So that's legally binding.
My fingers are crossed.
Definitely. Definitely.
That old legal loophole, my fingers were crossed. Well, Claire, thank you so much. It was, yeah, really, thank really you. Interesting to hear more about what you did. And hopefully the listeners, yeah, have a bit of a better idea about what a prison lawyer does and a bit more about you, which was really interesting. Thank you, so thank you.
Thank you and goodbye from me and my windy friends today.
Yeah, thanks, Fern.
She's got your eyes in her.
See you guys later.